And now Radio CJ, hosted by CJ Grace.
It's enough of a feat to be the very first person to go around the world in an open cockpit ultralight aircraft. But it's even more of an amazing thing to have achieved when the man who did it is scared of heights. He's my guest in the studio today, Brian Milton. Thank you very much for being on the program.
You're very welcome.
So why exactly did you become scared of heights?
I was a BBC reporter, 36 years old, married, two children, and a hang glider pilot. And we wanted to make the first flight from London to Paris by Microlite, which is essentially a hang glider with a very small engine on it. It was a 101cc engine, really loud. And I was out practicing on November the 13th, 1978. And there was a BBC television crew there watching. And I had taken off and made two flights, but the whole conditions had changed during the time we were flying.
And this was a prototype powered hang glider, was it?
That's right.
So at that time, it was brand new, experimental, never really been used before.
We wanted to find out where to put an engine on a rag wing. Remember, this is a rag wing. You could fold the whole thing up and stick it away in your garage every night. And in the configuration I had, the engine was above the pilot and there was a big propeller sticking out the back. And you had two throttles. One throttle was a hand throttle, which is normal, and the other one was a big peg in your mouth. And you bit the peg, put your harness tight, bit it and ran. They said, run like a pig. And then after you got into the air, you spat the peg out and and used the hand throttle to climb. And essentially what I was doing was I was going into this bowl and I was under instructions to circle.
The bowl was a geological formation that you were flying over.
There was a Roman fort there 2,000 years earlier.
And this was in Britain, somewhere in Wiltshire, was it?
In Salisbury, near Salisbury Plain. So Mere in Wiltshire, it was called. And I went out the third time to go and fly, and I knew conditions were funny. I went into what was called a powered stall. I won't go into the technical details, but essentially the wind was blowing in one direction at one time in the air and in another direction at the other time in the air. It's called a shear line, and it can bring down an airliner.
So it's as if you've got two different kinds of wind meeting each other.
That's right. You move from one to the other. And I moved from one to the other, and in one part of the air, I was not stalled. In the other part of the air, I was stalled. Anyway, what happened was I stalled, did a handstand on the bar. The thing flipped right over. I fell into the sail. Two outer parts of the sail folded up. I flipped again, and then, it's called clapping hands, I fell 250 feet to the ground.
By clapping hands, you mean the wings of the craft
hit each other. Yes.
And you plummeted.
And this was all on film. I have a website, brian-milton.com, and in it there's a video section. And if you look at any one of the videos, Wind, Sand and Stars, you'll see it in there.
So how far did you fall?
250 feet. In England terms, it's half as high again as Nelson's Column. In American terms, it's probably higher than the middle span of San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge. So it's quite a long way to fall. But I took more than 6 seconds to hit the ground, whereas I should have done it in three. And instead of hitting the ground at 72 miles an hour, I hit it at 36 miles an hour.
Why was that?
Because part of the sail didn't fold up, and the central triangle in the middle was sort of like a large umbrella. I mean, I thought I was going to die, obviously, and as I plummeted down, and I hit the ground with the right side of my face and my right shoulder and blacked out. And I came to, it must have been very quickly afterwards, because I was lying on my back watching the clouds go by and just imagining I was dying.
How did you manage to survive?
First of all, the whole sail didn't break up. Secondly, the farmer, Rodney Coward, had ploughed the field the previous day.
Had it been raining and so it was softer?
It rained overnight. And I had no expectation when I hit the ground that I was going to go and live. So instead of tensing up, which would have broken an awful lot of bones in my body, I hit the ground like a rag doll. And I think that's what saved me.
So it wasn't a guardian angel looking down on you or anything like that?
I remember lying in bed with the reporter from the Daily Express the following day, and all he was saying to me was, go on, say it was a miracle. And you really have to have a particular belief in God to go and do that. And I really didn't think that I should go and put this whole thing onto God, such as he is. I thought this was chance that happened with me, and I got away with it like that.
So how did you go from there to being the first man around the world in this open cockpit ultralight? They call them microlights in Britain, but in America it's called an ultralight, right?
I was the captain of the British hang gliding team, and we had gone to America that year in 1978 and beaten the Americans. It was said to have been a watershed in the sport. So I got back into hang gliding quite quickly, because if I didn't, I would lose my position there.
That was after the accident.
That was after the
in
accident.
The powered hang glider, yes, that was experimental.
My major problem was working with power. I could fly without power, but it took me 6 years to fly again with power.
Because you were scared?
Yes, of course. You know, the first time I did it, I flew out of a place called Bristol Downs, which is a very large area. And I flew in what now looks like an ultralight. In other words, it's a hang glider wing with a motorbike underneath on the pusher propeller. And I took off and I climbed 250 feet and I got very frightened and took my foot off the throttle. And anybody watching it who knew anything about flying must have laughed their socks off, because I was in the air for only 5 minutes, utterly terrified. But I knew that I really couldn't live with myself and have be defined really as a coward if in fact I didn't fly with power, and that's how I got back into it. And one way or another, I mean, I do adventures anyway. I've had a fairly straight life. I had 10 years in BBC journalism and 15 years in television as a journalist and a presenter.
In financial journalism. Nothing to do with aviation.
No, not at all. But every now and again, you know, you dream about things and you think, you know, wouldn't this be a good adventure? And I wanted to fly a microlight from England to Australia, which nobody had done. And then when a girl did it, a girl called Eve Jackson did it, she took 15 months to do it, and she only flew when everything was utterly perfect. And one way or another, because I was a financial journalist, I was able to talk to financially successful people, people with money to spend. And I met a man called Terry Price. Tony Spaulding was his PR man, and Terry Price was the CEO of a company called Dalgetty. And I persuaded him to back me to fly to Australia in the microlight.
And this was an earlier adventure for the bicentennial of Australia, right?
That's correct. I fell out of the sky on November the 13th, 1978. And in 1988, I flew to Australia. 1998, I flew around the world. So the first really big, long, adventurous flight was the Australian flight. It was, in fact, in adventure terms, a much more interesting adventure than actually flying around the world.
Didn't you fall in the sea when you went to Australia?
I got wrecked on a Greek island first. I landed in very rough conditions on the island called Kythera, and the wind came in from the right and just flipped me straight upside down, and then drove me down the runway, scraping and banging and knocking holes and destroying the whole integrity of the microlight. But a friend of mine, Mike Atkinson, who I was employing, who followed me to Australia on first-class flight, carrying a spare engine as hand baggage, Mike turned up, and between the two of us, we glued the whole thing back together in 6 days and got it to fly across the Mediterranean.
This was glue that you could get from a local hardware store put on this aircraft, and you got it flying.
It was araldite.
Well, people in Britain would know araldite. They might not in America, but when I heard that you were gluing it together with araldite, my goodness. I mean, it's the kind of, you just go down to your local hardware store, get some glue it together, and off you go. I mean, it's amazing that you managed to do that, that it still worked.
That's exactly what we did. They didn't have hardware stores on Kythera, which was a pretty primitive island, but we got loads and loads of tubes of araldite. It's got two particular substances in it, and you mix them together and it hardens up. And I have to say that the man who designed the aircraft, I asked him out and paid for him to come out to test fly it. But then after he had shown that it could indeed fly again, I loaded it up and flew 300 miles to the island of Crete. And then the following day I flew to Egypt and carried on across the desert and came under the patronage of King Hussein of Jordan, which was a very big thing in the whole adventure, because he cleared me across the Middle East. And when I fell in the Persian Gulf on Christmas Day 1987, in the middle of the Iran-Iraq war, I was 32 miles away from Abu Dhabi, and I'd planned to stop for half a day in Abu Dhabi because I hadn't had a beer for a week, because you couldn't get a beer in Saudi Arabia because it's an Islamic country. Instead, I fell in the sea, and the aircraft was in the sea for 6 hours.
So you got salt water instead of beer?
I got salt water, but I got my beer. I got it later on. What happened briefly was they saw me go in on the radar, and I did signal Mayday, which is French, M apostrophe A-I-D-E-Z, in case you don't know. And
French for help me, help me.
That's right. And a helicopter was sent. First of all, an aircraft was sent, and he confirmed that I was in the sea. And then this helicopter was sent with two Canadians in it from an oil rig that wasn't very far away called Zakum 7. They appeared above me, and I handed them all my gear, which wasn't very much. And I climbed on board and said, can you take the aircraft? It's very light. And they said, no, no, it's unstable. And if we did anything with it, it would get caught up in the rotors and it would bring us down.
How come it didn't sink?
Because I had a mixing tank, a 5-gallon mixing tank, in what would have been the passenger seat. And it was empty and sealed.
So that was your buoyancy.
And 6 hours later, when I got back, she was still floating. Her tail was way down. The engine was under the water, but the nose and the leading edges of the wings were over the water. Basically, I had been taken by this helicopter, first of all, to have lunch and a cup of tea, and then to
phone London. You're British, you have to have a cup of tea.
Of course. And then I went to a place called Batin, which is an airfield in Abu Dhabi, and I was met by this young Arab who said to me, you're under the patronage of Sheikh Zayed. He was the man who owned a bank called BCCI. He said, what do you want? And the reason why he gave me patronage is because I'd come under the patronage of King Hussein of Jordan, and King Hussein had been a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad through his daughter Fatima. So I was under a really strong spell. And they just said, what would you want? And I said, well, I want to find my friend Mike. And then when we found Mike, he was walking around the engine wondering what to do. And I said, if we get out there by helicopter, Mike, we can pull it out of the water if we can do it without damaging it. And I'm pretty sure she'll fly again. Anyway, he just believed me. And the press in England was going mad because, you know, nothing goes on Christmas Day except Christmas. And then you got this lunatic, okay, former BBC journalist falling in the sea and was proposing to take it out and fly on with it. So I got chased by all sorts of people, including The Times. It was a front page, 5-column article on The Times.
The London Times.
And
you were also on National News in Britain.
Yes,
too.
I was. Yeah. It was the second lead. Which is a very big thing. The PR people who were looking after me all went out and had a few drinks that night.
To celebrate, because they certainly got their money worth out of sponsoring you.
Yes, they did. Well, in fact, the head of Dalgetty said in the end it was the best £100,000, which at that time was about $150,000. Best $150,000 the company had ever spent.
So how long did it take to get that aircraft flying again?
It took 6 days in all. We had a spare engine.
6 days? That's it?
Yes, that's right. It was such a simple aircraft that all we did was hose it down and make sure there was no salt water left in it. And all the instruments were ruined and the radios were ruined, so we had more of those sent out from England. But we had a spare engine, and we got the engine, just swapped the engine over, put the old gearbox on and oiled it and all the rest of it. And we got into Abu Dhabi on midnight of Christmas Day, and on the day before New Year's Day I was flying it again, and on New Year's Day I set off across 300 miles of desert towards Muscat.
Now this was a slightly different aircraft from the one that you went round the world in. This was not open cockpit.
It was an open cockpit, but it was very, very small. And the engine size, for anybody who's technical, was 447cc. When they talk about, you know, flying with lawnmower engines, that was a pretty reasonable lawnmower engine. It only had something like 40 horsepower. And I can remember taking off from Amman in Jordan, for example, with a full load and climbing at 50 feet a minute, which meant it took 10 minutes to get to 500 feet. And that is a very, very long time. The engine screaming and you're hoping you can just climb.
And it was very, very small inside.
I went mad over India.
Wasn't it about two-thirds of the size of a coffin?
Yes, that's right. You know, think about the exercise. I could lift my feet up 2 inches and waggle them around, and I could put my hands in front of me and waggle my hands around, but I couldn't do anything else. And over India, I had these psychological problems because I was, you know, I was frightened.
So you saw visions?
I saw something that I called the jinn, which appeared on the nose of my aircraft. I knew it was mad. I knew that it was a figment of my imagination, that it was inside my mind, but it was the only mind I'd got. And this thing stood there, and I'm coming up to the holy city of Allahabad. And I'd been in the air for hours and hours and hours. And I just suddenly went nuts, and this thing stood on the nose of the aircraft and told me to jump.
So it was telling you to jump out of the aircraft?
From 5,000 feet with no parachute. And I got within an ace of doing the thing because I knew that it was something to do with my mind, and I had to try and control my mind. And I controlled my mind by thinking of women.
Goodness me. Sex solves everything.
You can't do very much sexually when you're stuck inside something two-thirds the size of a coffin at 5,000 feet over India. You know, there was no way of getting rid of that thing except just to haul up all these. They're not unfortunate girls. I didn't do anything to them. They were just part of my imagination. But it turned out that the djinn was a dirty old man, and so I was able to distract him and get my mind back in. It took me 3 days, flying over some quite difficult parts of India and down towards Malaysia via Burma and that sort of thing, but I did it.
And did that come back on any other flights or not?
Came back a lot. I was always, on the flight to Australia, I was always fighting the djinn. But I knew that when I was flying after that, in the years after that, wherever I was flying, that the djinn could come back and haunt me. And in particular, I was worried about it on the flight around the world. But one of the characteristics was he normally appeared when I was alone, and he normally appeared when conditions were beautiful, smooth and clean, and there was no turbulence or anything.
Because
like
your mind wasn't engaged in having to fly a difficult flight.
That's right. When you're being thrashed around and you're hanging on for grim death, then you don't think about daft things like the djinn. But when nothing is happening and your mind is just cruising along and there's hardly anything really.
And you just have to go for miles and miles and miles and hours and
yes.
hours and there's no change.
No. And that was the thing in India, and I got it back when I flew around the world, even though I was flying with a companion, a man called Keith Reynolds. I thought he would be proof against that, but he wasn't proof against that.
Let's go on to the flight around the world. That was a different kind of flight. You had more political problems than physical problems with the aircraft. The aircraft, for example, that you took to Australia, it fell in the sea, what, because of engine problems?
No, it was a fuel blockage.
There was a fuel blockage. The flight around the world, you had fewer occasions of that sort. You didn't fall in any sea anywhere, but you were held up by governments all over the place.
The difference between a flight to Australia is it is classical. It was done first in 1919 by four Australians. And, you know, they went through places that at that time in 1919 were almost all British. India was British, Malaysia was British, Indonesia was Dutch. So there were no political problems, and there's a residue of that left over. Going around the world, you have to go via places like China, like Russia, and in my case, like Iceland and Greenland, because somehow or other the Danes got caught up in this whole culture of what we're deciding about your flight is for your safety, so you cannot go. And so we had problems going into China, and we had problems going into Russia. But the flight was on something that, in my terms, is also classical. It was like a very big hang glider with a motorbike engine underneath it, and the two of us sitting one in front of the other, and we had a triangle control bar, so it was like flying a hang glider.
Now, normally when adventurers go on long trips these days, they have a whole entourage. Maybe there's one craft doing whatever record they're trying to do, but then there is somebody carrying the luggage, somebody doing the filming, you know, a navigator, whatever it is. They all have separate crafts following this so-called solo aircraft.
There was a man.
Was that the case for you?
No. There was a man called Colin Bedill who made the flight around the world 2 years after me. But he hadn't got a co-pilot. I had a co-pilot for a while, for 32 days, Keith. Basically because I didn't think, I was 55 at the time, I didn't think physically that I was up to making so long a flight, flying for, I wanted to get around the world in 80 days, flying day after day, 300 miles a day. I just didn't think physically I'd be up for it. So when Keith
and,
said...
And a weight shift machine weight is shift pretty machine, physical, isn't
very
it?
Very physical. It's a bit like when things are rough, it's a bit like riding a willful horse, but you're riding him for hours and hours and hours. You know, the first thing you need when you land is a beer, because you really do feel that you've expended a great... I think I lost 15 pounds in weight when I was doing the thing, and I didn't notice it just happened. So we did it as a pair. We set off as a pair. We'd been sponsored by a prince, Prince Philip of Liechtenstein. I had met a man who knew a man, and the second man was a chap called Paul Loach, who's now one of my best friends. And Paul knew the prince, and the prince owned a company called GT Global. He's Prince of Liechtenstein. They'd had money for 600 years.
And so they sponsored you to go around the world.
They sponsored me to go around the world. And it was a very male sponsorship. I know you're a woman, and I know you like adventures, CJ, but... I think if a woman had been at that meeting, there were four men at the meeting when we discussed this whole thing, and they never raised the issue of money once. They got caught up in the whole romance of the idea of around the world in 80 days and an aviation first and a tiny little aircraft and all of that sort of thing. A woman would have asked rational questions about money and, you know, how much would it cost and all of that.
And probably with your previous record of having crashed into the sea, they would have said, well, what about the safety aspects of this tiny little craft?
You see, the people who backed me to fly to Australia said in the end that it was my attitude that they had backed. They had been able to see that, even though at the time I was a television presenter when I had made my pitch to them. And when
that you weren't going to give up, that you would just get through and finish.
Right. When you're on an adventure, they have their own demands, adventures do. And you really have to go and respect those demands. And I know that Prince Philip and I know that Paul Loach, Paul said to me later, he said, I knew you were going to come back with your shield or on it. And I remember when we did the budgets, there was a marketing budget, which was twice the operating budget. And Paul said, so that looks like about £1 million, which back at the time was $1.5 million. And I said, yes, and he just signed a cheque. But I had this immense responsibility to Paul and to the prince, which I never, never, ever forgot.
So why did two people start and only one person finish?
For most of the time, Keith was brilliant. He was a professional pilot. He'd never had an adventure before. This was, you know, he'd gone from having no adventure to having the big adventure.
And you'd organised an awful lot
I'd
of smaller adventures
thing.
Beforehand.
Yes, I mean, the flight to Australia was a smaller adventure.
You also, very early on in your adventuring career, went across Africa in an ancient automobile, did you not?
It was an Austin 7 called Alexa. It was 1968. I had been in San Francisco in the Haight-Ashbury district for a couple of years when that was really quite fashionable to be. But I went back to London in 67. And in 1968, I was working as a tour director, and I had this 1937 Austin 7. And I'd fallen in love with a girl called Fiona Campbell. She was from an upper-class family. She could trace her lineage back over at least 16 generations. She came from an old Scottish family called the Campbells of Argyll. Anyway, we had fallen in love, but she was going to South Africa, where she'd been born, and so we decided that it was going to be a love affair, and then it was over. And then months later, I was writing on the west coast of Ireland, and one night in the middle of a letter, I just suddenly started writing to her and asked her to marry me. And a month later, she said yes. And then I had to drive the Austin 7 across the Sahara and down through the Congo to get to her. So I made money, not a lot, but back then money was money. So I had £150 when I set off. And the car was at least 5 years older than I was. Ran out of water twice in the Sahara Desert, and I did 2,000 miles on just three pistons with no brakes and no lights. And I got invited to the consecration of a Congolese bishop, in which about 10 of us afterwards went off, and we had a drinking competition, which I swear I had to drink for England. And I can remember the hangover the following day, even now, you know, thousands of years later. And so I knew about adventures, and I knew that you just didn't walk away from them. But Keith didn't. And one of the things that corrupted the flight was that Sir Richard Branson, he was Mr. Richard Branson then, I had twice gone to him for sponsorship and he had twice turned me down. But when he saw what I was going to do, I got a phone call to say, come in, come in. I said, what for? And they said, we want to sponsor you. And I said, you can't sponsor me. I'm flying for an organisation that's a rival to one of your financial services. And then what happened was that they said, OK, we're not going to sponsor you. We're going to compete against you. And I said, well, fine. And then they phoned me up and said, when are you going? And I said, in 5 days' time. And of course, they couldn't get it in 5 days' time, but I knew they were waiting for us to fail. And Keith got...
So were they developing another aircraft to be able to go around the world in that?
Three other aircraft. All of them that looked like the one I flew to Australia, which was much faster with a big engine than our little GT Global Flyer, you know, the hang glider one.
The powered hang glider.
My average speed on around the world is 57 miles an hour. So helicopters can go twice or three times as fast as that. And the aircraft that they were developing, which was developed 10 years on from the one that I had flown to Australia, the aircraft they were developing with a big engine on could probably have done 100 miles an hour. Anyway, I was aware all the time they were under this threat from Branson. What happened is when things got very difficult in Russia and the Russians were holding us up, Keith thought that
they weren't going to succeed. They wouldn't give you a visa to go through the country.
They gave us a visa. The visa was going to expire on the Monday. And on the previous Thursday, Keith came down to breakfast and he said, if you haven't got me a visa by Monday, I'm going home. You have to remember, I was paying him $1,200 a week. I was paying all his expenses. He'd asked me on this adventure. It was my adventure. And I was upset, but it wasn't upset to go and shout at him or anything like that. And it struck me that the problem with the Russians is they wanted me to take a navigator, and you can't take a navigator in a microlite because there's just no room. You know, there's a pilot and there's a co-pilot and that's it. So I might have had to hire an aircraft at $60,000 or $70,000. Well, I hadn't got that money.
You didn't have that in your budget?
No, not at all. It was silly because, you know, other people could then come along and make demands like that. You really had to face them down. And I would just say to Keith, look, when it comes to renewing the visas, they're going to renew. Their Mr. Yeltsin is meeting our Mr. Tony Blair that weekend in London on what was called a G8 meeting. And Yeltsin was looking for $23 billion. And I said, do you really want a row over two Englishmen trying to fly across Russia to go and bugger that thing up? Because that's what he would have done. I said, there's just no chance that they're going to do this. But he didn't believe me.
This was in 1998, right?
This was in 1998. He just didn't believe me at all. And it struck me in the 5 days between the visas being renewed and Keith's threat, his ultimatum. If I had a back seat and I could find a Russian navigator who had balls, as it were, you know, courageous, and who wanted the money, and the money turned out to be $245 a day, then I could ask Keith to go and wait for me in Nome, Alaska, and I could fly across Siberia 5,000 miles with this Russian in the back. And it was a sort of miracle that I found one, a man called Peter Petrov. And he had a mistress. And what this adventure offered him was the chance to get money in cash, $4,200, not to be able to explain it to anybody where the money had come from. And he could take her off to Sochi, which is their equivalent of Maui. And as long as he stuck with me.
So that was his incentive to be on the flight with you till the bitter end to finance a holiday with his mistress.
Things went wrong. Things often go wrong. Okay, and in one of them, we ran into a storm and he really wanted to be on the ground. And so I stuck him on the ground in a place that was not worth sticking on the ground to. I made a judgment that I couldn't get off with him. And this was the middle of nowhere. There were no roads or anything like that. I just said, you have to find a way to go to Magadan, which was where we were heading towards, which is where all the gulags were organized from inside Russia. Really a tough place. And I said, if I can get off, I'm going to fly to Magadan and I'll wait for you there. And he went through that. I remember him in the back day after day saying, it's cold, it's cold. And we were up near the Arctic Circle and we were flying in conditions that were pretty awful. It's open cockpit, you know, you're up at 5,000 feet. There were very odd conditions, so you'd be climbing on tick over on, you know, no power in the engine at all, and you'd be descending like a great lump of lead with full throttle. But we got around, and we got to Providinia, and he came across the Bering Straits with me, and I'm incredibly grateful to him.
So he was pretty brave, and it was all for, what did he call his girlfriend?
It's a like woman. He kept saying to me, and I tried to work out what a like woman was, and it's obviously his English wasn't brilliant, but my Russian was non-existent. I could say spasibo, and that was about it, which was thank you. And that's what I kept saying, thank you, thank you. Without him, I don't think I'd have been able to do it at all. But what happened was that Keith, who had agreed to meet me at Nome, didn't. He went home.
What happened? He was upset at not having gone all the way around with you.
That's right. And he talked to me on the phone and he sounded very good. But I personally believe that he didn't think on my own I'd do it, because the general consensus in England was that on my own I'd fail. And he left me out there, you know, in chilling terms, left me out there to die. And when
because you were expecting to have a co-pilot going from Nome, Alaska, all the way back to
Via
Britain.
San Francisco and New York. We were following Phileas Fogg, do you remember, around the world in 80 days. So I was following as far as possible his route. And so I followed his railway all the way from San Francisco over the Rockies and across the Midwest and into New York. And then Phileas Fogg went to Liverpool by boat, but I couldn't do that. So I had to go up to the Arctic Circle again across the Atlantic, and Keith was supposed to be with me on all of that. But given what he had done, I now think that I was really lucky that I did it on my own, because I had no arguments with myself. Either I went or I didn't go. And in the Atlantic, I turned back three times because I just thought, this isn't going to work. I'm going too slow. The wind's wrong. And of course, what happened with Keith, he was very upset when I did do it and sued three times.
He sued you for having not died and fallen in the Atlantic.
No, he sued me for not having paid him for the time he missed out 4 weeks on his contract, and he thought he should have been paid for that, even though he was at home in England working as an instructor. He also sued me for his airfare home. I'd been saying, please don't go, please wait for me, but now he said, I'm going home. And then I'd left some wings at his airfield, and he started charging me for those as well. So it was a very poor ending.
Well, I don't know how poor that ending was. I mean, if you look at the Brian Milton Wikipedia page, I'm wondering, is there any member of the royal family in Britain who has not presented you with an award?
No. I got a big trophy from the hang gliding community from the Queen. I got a trophy from Prince Charles for beating the Americans.
At hang gliding.
I got a trophy from Prince Andrew for flying around the world. And Prince Michael of Kent, because he saved our ass when we were trying to get through China. You know, he happened to be a visitor to China at the time, and we were in Hanoi. I still remember walking past the Hanoi Hilton every day, which is where all the Americans were imprisoned during the Vietnam War. And Prince Michael of Kent just said to the Chinese, he was asked by our embassy, you know, can you help these two Englishmen? And of course, it would have been a great loss of face if they'd said, no, go away.
And before that, they were denying you a visa
that's
to fly
right.
through.
Yes, that's right. So I had lots of adventures, and the royals were a big thing for me. They really, you know, there's no reason why they should. It's just noblesse oblige. And when you're in a really tight corner, it's really good to have a prince to call on, because he doesn't need a committee. He doesn't need a majority vote. You talk to him as a human being, and if it appeals to him, it works.
Now, when you were presented with that award for hang gliding for beating the American team, you had just fallen out of the sky, hadn't you? And you were all bruised and black and blue.
Yes, trying to explain. And I saw Prince Charles 10 days after the fall. I was 2 days in hospital. And there was quite a big television program. It was a 13-minute story on Nationwide, it was called. It was a Nationwide program. And so I turned up to see Prince Charles for this presentation. And I had a big black eye. Almost one side of my face was black. I had my right arm in a sling with a spiral fracture. My left wrist was in plaster, and I was bruised. I was falling. I fell asleep six times a day because of the shock. And I remember him saying to me, you know, smiling, very nice.
This is Prince Charles.
This is Prince Charles, saying hang gliding is one of the aviation sports I haven't tried. And I looked at him and I thought, if your mother saw me as an example on there, I'm pretty sure she'd ban you from doing this. And finally, I had a really funny incident with Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh. He was president of the Air League, and I got presented to the Air League after I'd flown around the world. And what they did was they didn't give me any medal, they just saluted me. But at the end of the presentation, he walked over and just smiled and just said, "You're mad," and turned around and walked away.
So that's Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh.
The Queen's husband.
Yes, well, he's attested to the fact that you're absolutely mad. And we've heard about mad dogs and Englishmen, and you are an example of a mad Englishman.
That is not true.
Thank you very much, Brian, for being my guest today.
CJ, you're welcome.
So if you'd like to find out more about Brian Milton, first of all, check him out on Wikipedia. You'll find out about all those awards that he's been presented by pretty much every member of the royal family in Britain. And if you want to see some video or read more of what he's written, take a look at his website, brian-milton.com. You can actually see that terrifying fall he did back in the 1970s, falling 250 feet in the experimental powered hang glider that we spoke about earlier on in the interview. And there's a lot to see on that website.
Radio CJ was presented and produced by CJ Grace. Thank you for listening.